and then you can enjoy the rest of the lectures. Besides that, when you give an overview, all you do is present basically the material that's in the book and leave the details to the other speakers. So I don't have to deal with a lot of interpretation in my presentation this morning. Very glad to be with you today and that you are able to come and be present for the beginning lecture of this very important lecture series on this great book of Zechariah. Zechariah is called a minor prophet, but it's only because of the brevity of the book and the books that are referred to as minor prophets, Hosea through Malachi, whereas the others, Isaiah through Daniel, are referred to as major prophets, although Daniel only has 12 chapters. But Isaiah has 66 chapters, and Jeremiah 52, and Ezekiel 48, and so the brevity of Zechariah with just 14 chapters shows it to be a minor prophet in volume, but it is certainly not a minor prophet when it comes to teaching, to references to the Messiah, and many great things that are contained in it. Zechariah was one of three contemporary, or rather three prophets that prophesied after the Babylonian captivity. Haggai, who was his contemporary, and Malachi, who followed about 75 years later perhaps. And Haggai and Malachi overlapped each other in very close proximity. Without doubt, these prophets knew each other, although they do not refer to each other by name in their books. But their books are both dated. And I have a chart in the outline in the book, and you can look at that outline and see that they date their prophecies within months of each other. His name means Jehovah remembers. Nearly all of the prophets' names have something to do and some bearing upon either their message or their personality, and so their names are very important. He is one of 30 men in the Old Testament by the name of Zechariah. John the Baptist's father was Zacharias, the Greek form. And so we do have an advantage, though, in identifying him because he tells of his lineage. He is the son of Berechiah, the grandson of Iddo, the prophet. And Iddo is listed as one of the priests that returned with the first group under Zerubbabel in Ezra chapter 1. Well, he's identified in Nehemiah chapter 12, verses 1, 4, and 16. And so Zechariah is from a lineage of prophets and priests. And I believe that that will have bearing on his work as well. There is no reference to his call to office. However, in chapter 2 and verse 4, he is referred to as a young man. The angel said, "Tell this young man." And so from this, many Bible scholars conclude that Haggai was probably an older prophet, and Zechariah was the young man coming along. And there are some other things that we'll get to in the book that may indicate that that would be true. Now, both of them have the task of stirring the people up to rebuild the temple. Now, you recall that Israel and Judah separated from themselves after the death of Solomon and became independent nations under different kings. Judah was God's people, and David the king was from the tribe of Judah, and the Messiah would come through the branch of David. Now, the people of Israel had 18 kings, and they were none of them good. And because of this, they were carried away by the Assyrians in 721 and scattered among the nations. They never did return to their home country as a body of people, but came back individually and joined themselves to the people of Judah in Palestine. The Judeans continued. They had 18 kings and one usurper, Athaliah. But then they too became very wicked, and after Josiah, their last good king, died, there had not been a reformation in the hearts of the people, and so they were carried into captivity. They were carried away by Babylon in three different stages. In 606, Daniel and his friends went into captivity. That marks the beginning of the 70 years prophesied by Jeremiah. And then in 597, Nebuchadnezzar came back again and took Ezekiel the prophet and other notables. And then in 586, the people rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and he came this time and destroyed the city and the temple and carried the rest of them away into captivity. Now, the temple was destroyed in 586. They had started into captivity in 606. And so you have that 20-year difference. Now you come down to when they came back from Babylonian captivity. In 538, the Medes and the Persians overthrew the Babylonians. And very soon, according to Daniel's prophecy, Cyrus would let them return and rebuild their city and the temple. When they came back, around 50,000 strong, according to Ezra chapter 1, they began rebuilding the temple. They laid the foundation. But then, because of the opposition of the people that had come into the land while they were out of the land in Babylon, Samaritans and various other peoples, the work on the temple was stopped by official decree. And it was up to the prophets Haggai and Zechariah in the second year of Darius the king to get things going again. And so 16 years later, the temple is begun again. And that's where Haggai and Zechariah come in. They were to awaken the people from what was selfish lethargy, I believe, that is described in the book of Haggai, and a sinful condition that was redeveloping among the people described in Zechariah. David Barron, I believe, hits the nail on the head when he says that Haggai's task was to rouse the people to get the physical work of the temple going again. But it was up to Zechariah, with his visions and other things, to stimulate the people spiritually to clean up their sinfulness and be prepared for the worship of the temple when it was rebuilt. Now, as with all of the books of the Bible, 150 to 200 years ago, men began to criticize the writers and the authorship of the books, and they say that Zechariah was not the sole author of his book, but that part of it was written in the time identified as the second year of Darius, 520 BC, but later portions of the book were written by some other author or authors. Now, these kind of criticisms have been answered abundantly for several years. In fact, Brother J.W. McGarvey wrote an entire book on the authorship of Deuteronomy to dispel the higher critics and their views of the writings of the Old Testament. And so this is, but it seems that the higher critics are still being believed. And thus, you have to deal with them when you teach the books of the Old Testament. At least I do in my classes, and show that the Bible authors are the correct writers and that they are the sole writers of the Bible books. I'm not going to get into a lot of, in fact, I'm not going to get into any of the criticism part. You can read that in the book. I'll just skip on down to an analysis of the book, which is probably more, would be more interesting to us anyway. But when we look at the book, it is divided very easily into two parts. You have the first eight chapters, and then the chapters 9 through 14. And there is a distinct difference between the content and, it seems, the approach of the prophet in these two sections. Zechariah begins with a call to repentance in the first six verses. And he reminds the people of the sinful behavior of their fathers that had brought on the Babylonian captivity. And he says that they be ye not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets cried. The prophets before the captivity had done their best to warn of things that were going to befall them if they did not repent. They did not heed the warnings, and they went into captivity. And so Zechariah begins his book by telling them, don't be like your fathers. Listen to the warnings of the prophets. And when we look at the book of Zechariah, we see that it begins with the encouragement to rebuild the temple. But when you look at the very last chapter of that book, the temple is being destroyed again. They didn't pay attention to the prophets, the former or the latter. In verse 7 of chapter 1 and through chapter 6 and verse 15, we have a series of night visions. These night visions seem to have taken place all in one night. And these eight visions appearing to Zechariah, I believe each one of them is designed to cause the people to get busy and rebuild the temple. Haggai appealed to the people by showing that God's blessings were being withheld because they were seeing to their personal needs and not the things of God. He accused them of living in their sealed houses while the house of God lays waste. And then Zechariah appealed to them by emphasizing the spiritual aspects of getting the temple rebuilt, as we shall see. And so in vision 1, which is in chapter 1, verse 7 through 17, he sees a man among the myrtle trees. The man is a rider on a red horse, red sorrel and white horses follow after him. These seem to be patrollers of the earth who report that the land is at rest, which is bad news. It's bad news in the fact that though the earth is at rest, the people of God are not working on the temple. It seems that the former enemies of God's people are enjoying peace while Israel is still being harassed and suppressed by her enemies. The Samaritans had gotten an official decree from the Persian government to stop the building on the temple. And so there was a cessation of work that had lasted now for 16 years. And so the point that the man on the among the myrtle trees, this vision is that though the land is at rest, God's people are still being harassed, and they need to be stirred up to get to work and overcome these enemies. Vision 2, the four horns and the four smiths. The word smith is simply an old term that we would refer to as a craftsman, a blacksmith, a silversmith, a goldsmith. We get the point. And so these craftsmen, the four horns are symbols of power, and I believe symbols of the powers that have harassed and abused and caused hurt to the people of God through several centuries. The Assyrians and Babylonians, to be specific. And maybe he even has in mind the four kingdoms identified in Daniel's prophecy: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Now the vision sees the horns as already broken. That being true, this is what is referred to as the Hebrew prophetic perfect, which means that though these are events that take place in the future, they are described as already taking place. As far as God is concerned, the enemies are already put down. They have already been judged and punished. Now the smiths are the artisans or craftsmen who overthrew the four horns. And the meaning of the vision. Seems to be that there is no opposition to the building of God's temple that cannot be overcome. If you will put your trust in God and not fear the enemies, then God will bless you and you will succeed in doing his bidding. In the third vision, we have the man with the measuring line. He is a young man described as going out to measure the city of Jerusalem. Now, I don't believe that he is measuring it for protection, to rebuild the wall for protection, although that would come later on in the book of Nehemiah. But it seems to me that this vision of the man with a measuring line and his being stopped by the angel from doing this is to show that the Jerusalem of the future is going to be a city without walls, without limitation as far as growth is concerned. And it points to the new Jerusalem that was to come under the Messiah. In vision 4, we have Joshua the high priest. Now this is not Joshua of 1,000 years previous, but this is Joshua the high priest. And he is standing before the Lord, and he is being condemned or accused by Satan. And Joshua is dressed in filthy garments. He is described as a brand plucked out of the burning. He is one who was taken from the fire of captivity and restored to the priestly office. But Satan is saying he is not fit for the priesthood. The filthy garments represent the sins of the priesthood and the people. He is not fit. But in the vision, Joshua is given new garments, and he is thus restored to his place as high priest and able to serve. God declares him clean and ready and able to serve again as priest. In vision 5, you have the lampstand standing two olive trees. The two olive trees, I believe, represent Zerubbabel and Joshua. the civil and spiritual leadership of the country. Zerubbabel was the governor, Joshua the high priest. And they are, in this vision, are given assurance that the temple will be rebuilt. Zerubbabel will complete the building by laying the capstone. That would be the topmost stone, the last stone that would go into place. And he will be alive there to do that. So God is going to be with them as long as this leadership of civil and religious governments follow God. Though the new temple did not compare to the glory of the original built by Solomon, they are told that one should not despise the day of small things. Then in vision 6, we have the flying scroll, or we might simply call it a billboard. The scroll is 30 feet by 15 feet, and it's flying through the air. On the banner is written excerpts from the law, which contain threats and curses upon violators. The banner flies over the land, and its curse destroys the houses of thieves and liars. This seems to be a warning to obey the law. And these two, I don't know particularly why these two laws would be singled out from the law of Moses, but probably they are representative of all of the Ten Commandments. And they are to keep the law and to worship and serve God properly. Then the one that I particularly find very interesting is the woman sitting in a basket. A woman in an ephah. She is represented as wickedness. She is put down into the basket, and a lead lid is put on top of the basket to keep her in. And so the evil is represented as being shut up into the basket. Two storks, identified as angels, carry the basket back to Babylon, to the land of Shinar, which seems to be then representative of the beginning place of sin and the seat of sinfulness and wickedness. She is borne back to Shinar, where sin finds its natural home. With the rebuilding of the temple, wickedness is to be removed from the land. The last vision, number 8, is the four chariots from between the copper mountains, chapter 6, 1 through 8. In this last vision, Zechariah sees four horses and four chariots come out from between two mountains. These represent the four spirits going out from the presence of God. These go forth in judgment to avenge the abuses of Israel that were reported by the horse patrol of the first vision. The four nations that had been seen as causing Israel grief and hardship and heartache, even though they were acting as God's messengers, they are to be judged themselves. And these patrollers were to go north and south. If they go to the north, they would be heading for the nations like Assyria and Babylon and Persia. Going to the south, they would be going to their ancient enemies in Egypt. All of them that had been hurtful to the children of Israel in her history. So they are not only prosecuting the wrath of God, but they are providing for the providence of Israel and Judah at the same time. Their peace is in God. Now, briefly, we summarize the visions as being designed to encourage Zerubbabel and Joshua, the governor and the high priest, in their work. Their enemies are not going to be obstacles to the rebuilding of the temple. If there is true repentance on their part, sin will be removed from the land. Jerusalem is typical of the new Jerusalem, a city without walls. And faith and obedience will bring the advent of the Messiah, the branch, and his kingdom. In chapter 6, we have the coronation of the Messiah. And in this beautiful chapter, we have a depiction of Joshua the high priest receiving a two-tiered crown. Now, it was not common at all that a priest would wear two crowns. In fact, it just didn't happen. And so there is symbology to this, and it refers to the one who is to come, who is the branch, who will be the priest king, the Messiah. A great passage here, and you won't want to miss the lecture on this. Then in chapter 7 and 8, we have questions about fasting. They wanted to know, should we keep the fast that we have been keeping for so many years, especially during the time of captivity? And Zechariah makes it clear that God wants obedience, justice, and kindness. If you practice these things, then the need for fasting will no longer be necessary. Then section 2, chapters 9 through 14, nearly all commentators are unanimous in agreeing that these are some of the most difficult passages to be found in all of the Bible. It contains three sections that are not clearly related to the rebuilding of the temple. The historical circumstances are different. Many Old Testament scholars believe these last chapters were perhaps written 40 to 50 years after these visions, the series of night visions. And that, of course, could be very probable. Daniel's preaching, prophesying, lasted over 70 years. Isaiah prophesied 40 to 60 years. And so it would not be unusual for Zechariah to preach and prophesy for another long period of time that would focus on future things and events that were to come. The subject matter of these chapters focuses on the problems of the Jews in the period between the Testaments. You know, there are many books written entitled The 400 Silent Years. They are silent as far as inspiration and revelation are concerned, but they are far from being silent. There is a tremendous amount of activity going on that affects God's people in this 400 years between the Old and the New Testaments. And there is a lot of information in the book of Daniel, in the book of Zechariah, and other prophetic books that tell of some of these events, if we will, I believe, interpret them properly. The prophecies of this section are the ones most frequently cited in the gospel books, the gospel accounts of the humiliation and suffering and death of Christ. And so they are very messianic. The two main divisions open with the phrase an oracle or burden. The burden of the word of the Lord, chapter 9, verse 1, and chapter 12, and verse 1. Chapter 9 records the coming of the Greeks who conquer the ancient cities of the Philistines along the coast of Palestine. Zion, in turn, is announced as triumphant over the Greeks through their Messiah. He is described as the triumphant king, but he is meek and lowly and rides into his capital city on a colt, the foal of an ass, as recorded in Matthew and Luke. His dominion is from sea to sea, of course, pointing to the messianic time. Chapter 10 tells of blessings coming from the Lord. It's his by the Lord's signal that he will call his exiles home from the places where they have been scattered. And there will be signs accompanying them like when they came out of Egypt. In And I believe, again, that this is speaking of the new day, the day of the Messiah of the New Testament. In chapter 11, we have the good shepherd and the foolish shepherds lamenting the fate of the sheep under foolish shepherds. God commands the prophet to take charge of the sheep. He is to take two staves that are referred to as beauty and bands. In 1 month, three shepherds are cut off. There are as many as 40 different ideas presented as to who these three shepherds are. The good shepherd despairs and asks for his wages. And he is paid with 30 pieces of silver, which are given to the potter. The staff, beauty, is broken, signifying the God's broken covenant with Judah and Israel, and what would be the fate of the people. And then you have the day of the Messiah being described in chapters 12 through 14. In these chapters, in that day, occurs 16 times. In that day, in that day. That day, I believe, points to the time of the coming of Christ, the Messiah, and the events that would accompany his establishment of the kingdom and the Christian dispensation. In chapter 12, Jerusalem will become a burdensome stone to her people, but the righteous shall be saved. There is great mourning for one who is pierced, but the spirit of grace and supplication will be poured out. In chapter 13, there is a fountain opened in Jerusalem for sin and uncleanness. Idolatry and false prophets and those with unclean spirits shall pass out of the land. Then in chapter 14 is the announcement of the approaching day of the Lord, with an assault on Zion, the intervention of God, and men fleeing from an earthquake. Again, I believe that this points to the time when Jerusalem would be destroyed again in the time of the Romans, 70 AD. In conclusion, the book of Zechariah is the gospel in miniature. It begins with the rebuilding of Jerusalem and ends with its destruction. The rebuilding of the temple was an interim temple for fleshly Israel until the true temple of God, the church, came into existence. The destruction of Jerusalem and the temple described in Zechariah is pointing to the end of Judaism and the Old Testament system. This happens as a result of the Jews' rejection of Jesus, their Messiah. Zechariah provides us with a great and wonderful prophetic look at the coming Christ and his kingdom. He is our leader, our shepherd, high priest, and king. He is the meek and lowly king who reigns from sea to sea. He is the one betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. He is the one whom they pierced, the smitten shepherd. His atoning blood and sacrificial death is the fountain of cleansing for sin. The Apostle Paul appeals to the book of Zechariah with the demand that everyone is to speak truth with his neighbor. The book of Revelation finds antecedent in several different visions, the four horsemen, the two olive trees, the candlestick with seven eyes, and other places. Zechariah fills an important place in the book of God. Some of the very greatest preaching on Jesus Christ is found in Zechariah and in his prophecies. We need to study and meditate and preach them. Zechariah is a great book, and I believe that if you will follow along in these lectures closely, that you will be very greatly benefited and built up by the teaching from this book. Thank you very much.